Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality they find below the surface.
Yes, yes. And I apologize to everyone, for I am liberally perfumed today. And
I could tell before you even came on the computer. Your scent preceded you.
That's right. That's good. My eau de panache what I use.
It's called eau.
Oh, sorry. Eau
en français.
De panache. El francés.
I love it.
We're going to talk about The Grand Budapest Hotel, a movie by Wes Anderson from 2014. And I picked this movie, and I watched this movie a long time ago, and I absolutely loved it. And I really didn't realize at the time that Wes Anderson was a thing.
He's a thing.
You know,
he's
a
thing.
Yeah, he's definitely a thing. He's one of those directors that has a very distinct style and has rabid followers and detractors, right?
He is, right, exactly. He is what they would call one of the new great directors. He's called that. And very much kind of like, you know, in the olden days, you would have talked about a Woody Allen or Alfred Hitchcock. And he's, a lot of people would say he's an auteur. Mm-hmm. Which is somebody who, often it's somebody who focuses on one message over and over again, but it can also be somebody like Hitchcock, who just has such a distinctive style that it doesn't matter what they're talking about or making movies about, you can tell them just the minute the movie comes on. And Wes Anderson is one of those people, you know, with his super elaborate production on the set, which is a joy to look at, with his center framing, with his tracking shots, with all his things he does. You watch it and you just see over and over and over, here's his style.
Yeah.
And people love him or hate him. I don't hate him. I just don't really tend to like his movies very much. This
gotcha.
Is kind of the exception. This
oh,
is kind of
good.
Like, you know, the Coen brothers, you know,
yeah.
where
yeah, I was
Brother
say
Warwick
that.
Was about the only movie theirs and True Grit now
yeah.
that I've ever liked. So
That's kind of what this feels like a little bit to me, you know, because I haven't seen any of Wes Anderson's other movies. I was looking at that the other day and I was like, oh, wow, look at all these movies I haven't seen.
You might be in for a treat.
Might be. But he's got that, you know, the quirky characters like, you know, Fargo or something, where, you know, everybody is just so odd and over the top. You know, that's just a similarity between those two styles. I don't know how far the similarity goes, but because Wes Anderson is definitely, this is a unique movie. You know, I'm trying to think of something specific to compare it to, but the honest truth is there's a lot of things to compare it to in little bitty pieces, because there's a lot of like connections with various other things, and it's almost becomes this Mobius strip thing of
right.
self-referential movie business referential stuff.
Right. It's really like his homage to a lot of different movies and set kind of in a history we all know, even though it's completely a fable.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. So quick summary.
Yeah.
So it's 1932. And I can't remember the name of the country. I didn't actually write it down, but it's a fictional East European
yes.
country. And it's about the Grand Budapest Hotel. There's this concierge named Gustav, played by Ray Fiennes, which he was fantastic. And Zero Mustafa
yes.
is lobby boy. And I thought the guy who played him, I don't even have it written down, and I apologize to him for that, but he was fantastic.
Yeah, I looked him up.
Good.
And he was really, he's been in maybe one other thing, and he wasn't really recognizable because I'd seen it.
Uh-huh.
But this is his big role. This is what people know him for, and I think it was possibly his introduction.
Oh, really? Man,
yeah.
that's amazing. His,
He was good.
I've got to find his name because I feel bad that I don't have it.
While you're finding it.
Yes, F. Murray.
I would like to say this is a nested story.
Oh, yeah.
It starts off with a young woman going to a graveyard to leave a room key at the memorial to an author. And then she starts reading a book called The Grand Budapest Hotel. And as she's reading the book, we start hearing from the author talking about the book, writing it. And then we see him younger talking about, here's where I got the story. And that's Jude Law, who is talking to Zero Mustafa, older Zero Mustafa. I mean, and this thing, as is the case with Wes Anderson, it is just loaded with big stars, often playing small roles. They love to work with him. And so then he starts, and they're at the Grand Budapest Hotel, and it's quite run down, but it's still going. There's a few people living there and working there. And as he starts telling the story, then we see the main part of the story, which is Ralph Fiennes is the concierge, and Zero is the lobby boy who becomes his protege. And that's where the bulk of the story takes place. But I liked the nested aspect of it.
Yeah, it was very Inception-like, wasn't it? It was like,
well, let's not get crazy, but yes,
it's like layer and layer and layer.
Yeah, there's a lot to keep track of at that point.
And not only that, but he changed.
I was like, do I need notes?
Yeah,
but I didn't.
Not only that, but he changed aspect ratios. Right? Is that what you call that when you know you've got the widescreen, and then when he's in 1932, it's, you know, when the hotel was bustling and. In the main part of the story, it was like a, I don't
16:9,
yeah.
Which is an old film ratio. And we were talking about that at dinner because Rose was saying that's one of his things too. He likes to use an older film ratio a lot of the time.
Mm.
So
yeah, well, it was nifty.
Anyway,
yeah, so and it was just gorgeous. I mean, the shots and everything, just something. And. But yeah, even though the very first scene, you know, where you see that little girl walking along, you know, getting ready to put that key out. Tony Revolori is the actor's name.
That's it.
Yeah. So, concierge Gustav, he likes to entertain older women. Is that a good way to put that?
Yes.
And they come for him. You know, they like to come for him. And then... man, the makeup job on Tilda Swinton.
So much latex, I imagine.
Incredible. She was great. And anyway, this one particular person that he saw who came once a year ends up dying. And he goes to the will reading and he is left a painting. And then from that, it turns into like a little heist film. And then it turns into
the family is upset. They want all her money. They don't want him to get anything. Mm-hmm. So Adrian Brody is wonderful as the evil son of
the
woman.
Right, right. And then it turns into a jailbreak movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, just these little layers and layers.
World War II beginning.
Yeah, I was going to say that. The entire thing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Yeah. The entire thing is on the backdrop. And I found that really interesting. This backdrop of impending war is just a constant presence in the whole story.
Yeah, because even the fact that Zero is at first, Gustav keeps calling the lobby boy an immigrant. And he's saying bad things about him because he's an immigrant when he gets mad at him. And then he finds out he's actually a refugee from war. And he's like, oh, well, I'm really sorry. I said all that stuff. And it's like, oh, so an immigrant's different than a refugee. I thought that was an interesting little distinction they made.
Yeah.
Not that it didn't necessarily mean anything. It was just, you know.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Yeah.
I found it so as well. Yeah, so I'm not sure what else to say about it in summary, other than let's just get into talking about it a little bit deeper. Not that there's a heck of a lot of depth, but it sure is. It sure is pretty and hilarious. I laughed and laughed. This last time I watched it, I was just, I loved it. I love it. This is just a movie that I need to have.
Well, and yeah, and it does reference all these other movies. So at one point, they're referencing things like James Bond type movies during the getaway down the Alp. There's also the secret society idea.
Yep.
Yeah. There's a spy thriller idea when the lawyer's on the run. There's, you know, it's somehow he manages to paste all these things. There's a sweet little love story. Mm-hmm. He pastes all these little pieces together with a continuous, kind of a bit rambling, but a continuous storyline so that you're being taken through this backdrop of all these movies in a way, and it works.
Yeah. At breakneck speed, I might add.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fast-moving movie.
Yeah. And it's not that long. It's 100 minutes. So I was watching it last night and I was going, oh, how long is this? Oh, good.
Yeah. Yeah. So if we, let's not worry about spoilers anymore. If you haven't seen it, please do.
Yeah.
Not that anything that we're going to say is really going to ruin anything at all, in my opinion.
Right.
It's one of those kinds of movies. some interesting things that I wanted to talk about. So first of all, it's in this East European country, right? In 1932, most of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he chose no accents, American dialogue.
People use whatever accent they have.
Yeah, I mean, what is his name? Harvey Keitel?
Yeah.
He was as Brooklyn is, right? So, you know, in this East European prison, you know, they didn't try to get him to do any other accent whatsoever. He wasn't pretending to be in some fictional East European country. He just spoke. And I thought that was a really interesting decision and probably a really good one.
Ralph Fiennes is still British. And I can't remember how to say her name. Saoirse Ronan is the girlfriend. She's very Irish and she sounds like it. You know,
they're
just all put in their places because it's a fable.
Yes, absolutely.
We're not supposed to think it's true, and he's not worried about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I agree with you, but I thought that was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool thing.
Mm-hmm. And the production design, as we mentioned, this thing looks amazing. You can watch it and just look at the backgrounds. And a lot of times, also Wes Anderson will use deep focus, which means that you can see the person in the front, but you can also see everything really clearly in the background. And there's so many little details. He'll use it a lot for things happening in the background that you're supposed to notice. But a lot of times that wasn't happening. It was just so you could revel in all the detail.
Yeah, and it was something. I'd like to maybe watch how we made this movie documentary or whatever. You know, I assume there was a lot of paintings and stuff going on. And I think that chase scene that you mentioned down the hill, skiing, I think that was stop action motion.
It was?
I think so. I'll verify that, but I think it might have been.
Well, it looked very real.
Yeah, I mean, it was really cool.
Yeah, because where they're skiing and then it's a bobsled run. And
Yeah. At least the skiing part down the hill.
Well, and the far away part I could see where they'd pull way out and then you just see the two tracks, the forks in the paths and the little skier and then the bobsled essentially going after the sled going after them. I could see that, but the up close stuff where they were showing it, I felt like that couldn't have been stop motion. I feel
like. For sure.
But maybe it was.
Yeah, but it was fun. And then I don't know, the hotel itself, the outside of the hotel, I mean, it did look like a cake. The confection, you said like a confection. Mm-hmm. And then these machines, I love the colonnade funicular that they get on. I don't even know if that's something that ever exists, but it climbs up a steep hill. You know, people get in and it climbs up the steep hill and they get off and they're at the hotel.
Yes.
But the hotel itself reminded me of the Overlook. You know, it was all isolated, right? And in, you know, in the mountains.
So. Oh, that's interesting. It just made me think of the grand old hotels from a time that is now gone before World War I. Definitely gone by the time of World War II. But I was thinking of old Agatha Christie books and movies like Grand Hotel, which I would have to watch again. I saw it many, many years ago, but you know, which were made in probably the 30s, I would say. And it's got these huge exotic hotels and all these very wealthy people and the perfect servants. And so that was the first callback, really, was that that sense of a different time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think there's a chase scene at the end where that girl, what's her name? She had the painting.
Agatha.
Yeah, Agatha, right. So she had the painting and she's running through the hallways and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That was definitely The Shining. To me, it seemed like a homage to The Shining. At least that's what came to my head. So.
Yeah, and it does make sense, especially, I see what you're saying, because a lot of those rooms were so narrow and uncomfortable, like where all the servants would be waiting to eat while somebody reads to them.
That was good stuff.
They're all crammed in there together. The room where Monsieur Gustave lived in funnily enough, a barren environment, really.
Mm.
He's surrounded by grandeur the whole time, but not when he's in his own room and he looks like he's eating cereal or gruel or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And then he chooses as an adult to stay there too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, nifty. Yeah, really, really like that.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the heist film turn that it took. That was really excellent and fun.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm not going to do any of it justice because it's just so funny. But
no, you can't.
I love when they're putting it in, putting the thing in the safe, and guy pokes in. Hey, the police are here, and then they're looking at everything. Oh my gosh!
Love Edward Norton's policeman.
Yeah,
because I expected him at some point to become the sinister policeman that we expect from the sorts of movies that were being copied, essentially. And he never did. That was left to Willem Dafoe, who was the evil henchman who was going around killing people and trying to get back the picture.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The policeman is always doing the right thing. You know, everybody's at one point when there's this huge gunfight going on and he shows up and he's like, what's going on here? And they're yelling accusations. They all stop. Mm-hmm. They're yelling accusations. He's like, everybody stop shooting. Nope, everybody. You're all under arrest until I figure out what's going on.
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I would say it's it's a lot of fun to watch. But was there any other reason you picked it?
No, it was simply just because I loved it.
Got it.
Yeah, there wasn't any real deep reason at all.
So it's the 10-minute podcast this week.
It could be. It could very well be.
No.
Yeah. One thing that I did find interesting, I don't know if you, I'm assuming you probably read Roger Ebert's review,
mm-hmm.
Which I read after picking it and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So he liked it quite a bit, which was cool.
Right.
But, you know, he started to talk about masks and things, and I watched the movie again. With that in mind, and that was a really interesting way to watch it, because there is a lot of discussion about illusion and a lot of discussion about it's really illusion, you know. There's illusion not only in the filmmaker, what he's doing, and this is that self-referential thing,
mm-hmm.
but it's also the illusion and the stuff that people project. And the concierge is always talking about that. You know, he talks to the lobby boy, how the lobby boy has to be completely invisible, yet always in sight. And they need
to be present, yeah.
Right. And he kind of needs to hide people's, you know, sins or whatever. I'm not trying to read meaning into it, but trying to read, you know, shield, you know, be there for people and anticipate their needs, no matter what their needs might be. And that was interesting. And then Gustav himself, you know. A scene that pops into my head is when he's in jail and Zero comes to visit him and he gives him this, you know, cause his face is all messed up and he gives him this big story about how he beat up this other guy and you should see the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're great friends, you know, and you wonder, at least I did, you know, is any of that even really true? You know, what exactly happened there? But, because he is always projecting this thing, you know. He's got a face that he presents to the world.
Yeah, you know, except what I mean? That I felt like every time he said stuff, we saw usually confirmation of it. So when he was saying he liked the older blonde one, you know, we're seeing it was a bit distasteful in some places, but the little montage of him with all these people. And when he was challenged on something, he didn't lie about stuff, I felt like. So the whole thing about when he meets Agatha, and he insists on interviewing her to see if she's worthy of Zero. And you're watching, getting more and more uneasy, feeling like he's just going to take her away because he loves her so much. He thinks she's so great. And Zero says, "Is he flirting with you?" And she goes, "Yes, he is." And he just kind of looks abashed. And so every time he starts talking about her, Zero says, "Don't flirt." And he'll stop and look out the window or whatever.
Right.
You know, I've been caught.
But I think that scene is another example. I think that the reason that Gustav is so enamored with her is that she's genuine.
He says it's because she's so pure.
Right. And he says, no matter what's going on, you're still just happy.
Right. She's her.
Right. And I think that he was amazed by that.
Well, and it's interesting because I read the Ebert review before I watched it. Because I remembered it just as this light, fluffy, fun movie. And so I was going, well, what can there be in this movie? So I read the review and he said, it's a movie about the masks we conjure to suit our aspirations and the cost of keeping up appearances. And I didn't agree with him. I didn't feel like I really ever saw that being talked about.
I totally agree that it wasn't really talked about, but in the examples that I just kind of showed, I think it is kind of a running thing. Whether it was meant to be a thing or not, you know, there's really no need to search for extra meaning in this. One thing that personally, not from anyone outside, that I felt when I watched this is that it is so self-referential, right?
Yeah, it is.
So self-referential, and not only that, but it's taking its inspiration from other movies. Mm-hmm. And pretty much exclusively, right? Mm-hmm. So it's in some way not really connected to the real world at all.
Right.
But yet we have all this collective stuff in our heads that Wes Anderson somehow taps into, but none of it ever really taps into reality.
Yeah, that's the thing about it's being a history that we're all familiar with, even though it's not a real history. He's using the collective knowledge of storytelling in the movies to build his fable with, which I thought was the part of the thing, it being a fun movie.
Right. And it's something that you know, he does particularly well, not having seen his other movies, but in this movie especially, he did that particularly well. But if all of our movies were like this, it would kind of suck, right? Because, something that I think is gone off the rails with some science fiction that's being written today is that science fiction people are reading other science fiction. They're inspired by other science fiction, but they're not inspired by, you know, real world stuff, which the great writers are, you know, and they still are, you know. I mean, I think of somebody like Neal Stephenson, they're still around. Someone like Kim Stanley Robinson, right, who do that. And then we think of like Joe Walton, right? Joe Walton wrote Among Others, and that is like kind of like this movie, right? It's super self-referential in the science fiction world, and she did it marvelously, in my opinion. But if everybody did that, it kind of stinks, you know. So it's like when people copy Wes Anderson, for example, which I assume that there are copiers or there will be, they're not going to be as good. It won't be as interesting. Because it's impossible for it to be so, because he's original, and what he's doing is what he's doing. But then whenever somebody tries to copy, they never get the whole thing. Right.
Well, and I think, yes, I agree. Yeah. And I think that you're making the point that occurred to me this morning when I was kind of turning the movie over, thinking, just thinking about the fact that it was just fun. It was Wes Anderson And I say indulging himself only in the most positive way, just meaning he just took out, let all the stops were out. You know, he just did it. And he did it for about $25 million, I think, not that, if I'm remembering the right numbers. And that can't be right, but I know he made a ton on it. So it means I remember having it recommended by all kinds of people and all ages of people. And so him being himself and turning out this delightful confection, as I think of it, is worth something. And so what that made me think of is, in the movie, speaking of it being self-referential, remember that cake from the bakery that we kept seeing? It's four little cakes on top of each other, each delightfully and beautifully decorated. And it keeps getting delivered in this wonderful box, tied up carefully with a bow, and you untie the bow and the box comes apart into like almost like a flat plate. It's just wonderful. Yeah. We'd all like to have that bakery. And so it's continually, we're seeing the boxes. We finally see people eating it. They're in a prison. They cut it into sections and they eat it in about two bites. And so what that made me think of course, is the cake is the movie. That, I mean, you know, it's the little sections. We see have the little sections. It's a bit of delightful, delicious fun that we absorb, and it's gone. And now what are we going to do? Because they eat the cake and then they start planning their prison break. Right. So it made me think of this. Sometimes we need movies that are like dessert. They don't all have to mean something, right?
True.
I mean, at the very basic level, to me, this movie was about mentorship and friendship, but it's such a basic statement because every story has to have something to build on or it's chaos. So he was building on that and his love of these other movies. But it kind of brought me to this question of what's the point of dessert?
That's an interesting question.
Yeah, because we all like dessert and we know we can't have too much of it. Or as you were saying, we get sick of it.
Yeah.
Every story can't be like that. Every story can't refer to other stories. They have to have some substance. But sometimes dessert is delicious.
Definitely is.
And so that's also related to, because the point of a dessert, I think, is it's just fun. It's, you know, we like to have all our food taste good, but dessert is just for fun. It's not for anything else. And so what is the point of fun as a Catholic?
As a Catholic, what is the point of fun?
Yeah.
Well, that's not something I've ever thought of before.
Ha ha.
What is the answer?
Your movie made me think of it.
I love it. That's good.
Because you just picked it because it was fun.
I did.
Which is counterintuitive for a podcast like ours.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking of, it's like, you know, that when I thought of the dessert connection, I was like, well, dessert is just to be enjoyed. And this movie is just to be enjoyed. And I have movies like that that I love, that I watch again and again. So, and you must also. So for me, some of them are Some Like It Hot. Oh my gosh, so much fun. But I probably never bring it up for here. There's so little to talk about. Indiana Jones, those movies, especially first one.
Yeah.
Pitch Black. Come on. Have you seen that?
Yes, I have.
Come on. Okay. Not really a point.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a bit of a point to all of them, you know, a love story, you know, adventure and discovery, whatever the point of Pitch Black was, they shoehorned something in there at the end, redemption through sacrifice, but it was so slight. It was mostly just cool.
Yeah.
And even books, you know, P.G. Woodhouse, there is nothing, there's no redemptive message to those. They're just fun.
They're just a good time. A movie that jumps to my mind is Sneakers. I love that movie, and I've seen it probably 10 times.
Yeah.
And that's an example. Yeah.
So what's the point of fun?
I don't know. I mean, it's like, I would say it lets you go. I mean, it lets you let go of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't. I'd love to hear what you came up with, but the thing that just comes to mind, having just heard the question, is that it's like when you play a video game or something. which I used to do a lot, but I haven't for a long time. But you get to let all of the worldly things go, and you do this thing, and then you come back.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like a stress reliever or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, there's the old saying, right? All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy.
Yeah, right.
Well, for me then, and so I realize I have an unfair advantage because I was thinking about this while I was walking the dog this morning. And because what that made me think of is the idea of leisure. And in America, especially, it seems to me, it's funny because we go overboard on everything, right? Yeah. So you're either just working super hard all the time or you're spending too much time with leisure. You're playing video games too much and you're trying to fight it because we are a privileged society. We can do that a lot of the time. Mm. But the point of leisure in the Catholic world comes back a lot of the times to Sunday and the Jewish world. And probably the Muslim world has something too that I don't have never looked into. So pardon me for, you know, not knowing, but, Because the thing that I thought was so fascinating is when I was reading a book by Abraham Heschel, who's a rabbi, or was a rabbi, about the Sabbath. Hmm. And man, he is in love with the Sabbath. And he talked about time being like a cathedral that God builds for us, which made me think of the liturgical world, right?
Mm, yeah.
And so he was pointing out at one point that... you know, God says you must rest on the seventh day, but he doesn't tell us what to do. It, you know, we take it as you should be doing something that's worthy of God and all this stuff. And, you know, the Puritans were always like, well, you can't play or have fun or do anything, but that's not what the Bible says. You know, your leisure time. And the church says, you know, use your leisure time for, you know, get together with your family, rest and recreation that's wholesome and all this kind of stuff, of course. And you should, they would also like you to focus on God, but God himself doesn't say that. God himself just says you need leisure. And so to me, you know, it's like you're saying, recharge your batteries and everything, but we like to work, work, work. If we're doing stuff for the church, we like to give, do things, because we can kind of see what's happening and we're active about it, and there's nothing wrong with that. But some of that leisure is also, you know, God took the seventh day off just to enjoy what he'd done, you assume. He rested.
And he says, yeah, one out of every 7 days. Shut her down, right?
Yeah, and I didn't stop to look anything up, guys. So if anybody's got comments, I, you know, bring them.
Yeah.
But it's that kind of thing when people go, should you really go to the movies on Sunday because you're making other people work? Should you? And I'm like, that starts to get too deep for me. I'm not responsible for everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I liked when actually Texas had blue laws. And so when I moved here, I was like, I'd go to the grocery store and you could buy food, but I couldn't buy a shower curtain for my new apartment. I was dumbfounded. By the whole concept.
Yeah, I've never heard of that before.
Oh, yeah. No, that's, you couldn't.
So they said you could buy food on Sunday, but nothing else?
Right. The stores were all shut. Food was considered a necessity of life, so that was open.
That is something that I was just talking with some people about just last night about Sundays. And, you know, so I live in a largely LDS community, Mormon community, and most of the places are shut on Sunday, except for the national chains and things. And it's getting less and more things are open on Sundays all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there is something, I lived in a small town before this, as those regular listeners know, I've mentioned it a few times, but there pretty much everything was closed, except for maybe a convenience store next to the highway. And there's just something really nice about that.
Yes. I felt the same way.
Yeah. It's just like, you know, everybody's just paused for a day.
Yeah. When they rescinded the blue laws, and I can't remember when it was, but a while ago, a lot of people I knew were upset. And I think it might have been before I was even religious at all. I just remembered feeling like a whole time of peace had been taken away because it was nice. And it was, you know, no one was saying you have to go to church, you have to do this, but there were the whole day, there was nothing open. Mm. And I still have kind of remained in that habit whenever I could. There were times when, you know, kids had games and this and that, but I like, you know, we'll go to a movie or the family will come over, you know, like Hannah and Mark will come over and we'll play games or whatever.
Yeah.
And, or a lot of times I'll wind up doing something with somebody else, but it's all leisure. Hmm. And it made me think of, then that of course can be extended to like prayer. Do we spend some time each day just doing nothing with God? A friend of mine was talking about a silent retreat she'd been on. I can't remember if I've mentioned that here or not, but, and I was, you know, going, oh, well, I don't have the money for it right now. I don't have the time, blah, blah, blah. And she was saying, I still remember walking out of the restaurant and she was still sitting at the table because there was a big group of people, but over her, over my shoulder, I could hear her saying, waste time with God, waste time with God. Hmm. And so that whole idea of leisure, we can apply it to our own lives. And, but we can also apply it to how do we worship? You know, because I think a lot of times it's easy to slide into, I'm doing this, you know, I'm helping put this retreat on, I'm helping do this, I'm following this prayer thing, I'm reading this thing, but do we just waste time with God? Hmm. For 15 or 20 minutes or whatever, and just maybe nothing happens. Probably not. But yeah,
that's interesting.
It's still refreshing.
Yeah. Yeah, you make me think a lot about my own Sundays. Yeah, so Sundays tend to be, you know, the catch-all, you know, which I know is not right. But, you know, it's like all the stuff that you couldn't get to easily can be done Sunday, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's the day that you have that people don't touch.
Right.
You know, and that's often how it becomes for me. But a typical Sunday is usually very quiet.
Yeah. Yeah. And for us, really long time ago, I read some book about leisure and, you know, it was very simple, but it changed the way we thought about our Sundays. And so we started trying pretty hard not to work on Sundays. Hmm. And, it really changes your orientation to the rest of the week. Saturday becomes very purposeful because you're not going to do laundry on Sunday.
Yeah, I can see how that would work, you know, and, yeah. And that's something that I've thought before as well. That's tangentially related anyway, is things tend to expand into the time that you have. Right.
Yeah.
So, right. You know, in daily life, you know, if you could spend the entire day checking email, for example, right? Mm-hmm. You could spend that could be a 14-hour activity. Or you could say, all right, I'm going to check it at, you know, if you just put some deliberation in it, you know, I'm going to check it at 10, I'm going to check it at noon, you know, and then don't let it run your life, right? Mm-hmm. Instead, just do it at very specific times. But there are a number of things like that.
That's funny you say that because lately I've started closing my email browser.
Mm, yeah.
And because otherwise I see that little window sitting open at the bottom of my, you know, my dock or whatever it's called at the bottom. And I just automatically keep checking it. And when it's closed, I have to make a deliberate choice to open it up. And I tend to forget to do it.
Yeah.
And well, almost there's nothing never wrong with is that. There anything that I needed to see in the last 10 minutes.
Right. Yeah, and the answer is most of the time, absolutely not. In fact, probably 99.999% of the time.
Yeah.
You know, I have my cell phone here next to me. You know, when you originally set up email and stuff, it's set up so that your email pings you, right? So every time you get one, you get to look at your phone. Well, you know, you get, I don't know, 30 garbage emails every day or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, and some good ones in there too. But that's the first thing you got to shut off is you don't need your phone telling you when you have an email. You know, so that needs to go away. Yes. And you know, that's a setting and all that.
Mine
stuff.
Is not even set up to have email come in.
Yeah.
I'll go out of town and my husband will go, oh, I'll set that up for you. And I'm like, well, text me if anything. Text is good enough. Okay.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, because I'm like, it's too tempting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for me, you know, with the work that I do and everything like that, you know, some side stuff and stuff, you know, I just need to have access to email in case I send something. But I can totally, and I've read, there's this guy that I really like to follow. His name is Cal Newport. He talks about deep work. And he wrote a book called Deep Work. But one of the things that he talks about is time being stolen away from you by things like Facebook.
Right.
You know, Facebook and your phones and all that stuff. And social media altogether, it's just like, you know, it has changed. He has changed completely the way that I look at social media. And I'm on Twitter. The only thing I'm on is Twitter. And Twitter for me is a very specific thing. I have a group of people that I really like to keep in touch with on Twitter, you know.
Right.
And that's who I'm with. It's like, you know, I don't follow Mr. Trump and all the stuff, you know. It's not my news source, you know, which it can just completely take over your life that way. But I follow very specific people it's like a group of friends, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be checked at any time. And yes, there's definitely days where I check it too often. There are definitely days when I'm checking email too often, and it's a constant distraction, and it keeps you away from being able to do any kind of deep thought. And when you're talking about things like the Sabbath, that's also, it's like a mini Lent every week in a way. It's still a celebration, right? You know, on the Sabbath day. But the thing is, if you let things go for a day a week, then you have that thing where when you pick it back up, it's a more deliberate, you know, what's important about this kind of a attitude.
Well, and also, you know, you said it's like a mini Lent once a week, and it could be, but what we found is it's like a mini vacation.
Mm.
And especially when we were first doing it, we're like, wow, what are we going to do with the rest of our day? We went to mass. Now this afternoon, we can just read, we could take walks, we can go to the park, we could do, but we would find ourselves doing stuff that we hadn't done for a while. Now, of course, eventually even that turns into a routine because such is life. But it's the idea to me of, we all kind of go, well, I need to do this on Sunday. And it's like God's going, take a vacation, put your feet up, rest. You deserve it. Have fun. And we're going, what is wrong with you? I have stuff to do. I would rather work, 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 work and be busy than just sit around and have fun. Mm-hmm. And so it's funny. And part of that may be because the whole idea of the Sabbath is, and you know, and I'm not saying it shouldn't be associated with God, but we tend to, I think in this country especially, think of that Puritan model. I should be sitting reading the Bible. I should be, you know, going and helping the poor. I should be, those are all fine things to do if that's what you want to do with your spare time, but you can watch the football game. If you're having people over, you're serving a meal together and you're enjoying the football game or whatever, there's nothing wrong with that either.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different kind of leisure and vacation and activity and catching up with each other. Most people can't fit in the rest of the time.
Yeah.
So why do we turn away that piece of cake? You know, it's to take it back to the movie. You know, you can't have it all the time, but God wants us to have it once a week.
Yeah.
I mean, that's generous.
That is a very cool thought. Yes.
Yeah. So that's what I got.
I'm going to think harder about that too. I appreciate this very much.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Stuff I needed to hear, I think.
Well, then you picked the right movie.
Well, isn't that amazing how that happens?
Well, when you're walking the dog and you're going, well, Lord, I have no idea. Do you have any ideas? And I did think of that. So it was possibly not inspired, but it was interesting to me how the dessert mirrors the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it's okay to just have fun with a movie. It's just we're going to almost never talk about them here.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're never going to talk about Some Like It Hot unless we just want to talk about trivia about making the movie.
Which is probably very interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, probably, somewhat, but it's, yeah.
Yeah.
The traces of the one reality are harder to find in Tony Curtis's personal life or whatever.
That's right. That's right. But yeah, the colonnade funicular. There's some one reality. Yeah. I need to have one of those.
Yeah.
I must.
I liked the one where they were going on one from the Alps when the priest, the whole trail
of
monks.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that was so cool.
Are you Gustav, whoever?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. I know. Never yes or I am or uh-huh.
Yeah. He was surprised. Every single time. He was totally surprised. Uh-huh.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Until he lost it. There's a monk asking it, so.
Yeah.
But when it went up, and then they had to step through to the other one that took them the other direction. Yeah.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, that cable car thing, that's something I've seen somewhere.
Oh, the crossing cable cars?
Yeah, where they stop in midair and they get on a different one. Do you happen to know where that came from? That wasn't a Bond. I know you recently watched the Bond. Wasn't it a Bond
movie?
Doesn't
seem like it, though. Okay. They would occasionally have skiing in mountains and cable cars.
That's what came to my mind. I don't know why, but I was just curious.
Yeah. Nope. Yeah. Nothing comes to mind.
That's right.
There's probably some website or many that have all the connections, but I didn't look for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the only other thing that I had about the movie, you know, returning again to that impending world war in the background.
Oh, right.
Just, you know, living with that kind of hunkering around is something that interested me and I was thinking about. It's almost like, you know, things bad are happening in the world, yet we continue on and we continue to make movies like this, right? you know, doing art while there's tragic stuff occurring.
Right.
You know, and there's a purposeness to that as well. And it kind of ties into the leisure thing as well, doesn't it? I mean, art is uplifting. It can be.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's always worthwhile.
Yeah. And you look at a beautiful painting. I would not call The Boy with the Apple beautiful, but now that I think about it.
What a magnificent painting that was.
Pardon me, please.
Oh, and you know what? Oh, yeah, go ahead. Finish your thought.
No, I was just going to say, though, it was kind of interesting that they're all after a piece of art, which is basically what the movie was. But, yeah, you walk into somewhere and you look at this gorgeous Van Gogh of trees in a park.
Yeah, yeah.
It just is what it is.
It is what it is, yeah. But it's good. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't have to mean something. It's just there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, anyway.
Yeah, what I was going to say was there's poetry quoted all over in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
And there was one in particular where he's in the elevator with Tilda Swinton, and he starts to recite a poem. And I'm like, and he talks about a grave and rubbings on the grave. And I was like, gosh, is that like Lovecraft or Edgar Allan Poe? So I looked it up, and you know what it is?
What?
It's nothing.
It's what?
It's nothing. It exists in the movie only. Everything, all of those poetry things don't exist.
I just assumed they were all made up. They didn't sound
They were all completely made up, yeah.
I assumed he had written them.
Right, and he did. And what was the point of that? It was funny. To me, I can just imagine him. He's like, oh, people are going to look this up. But you know what it is? It completes it. You know, it's almost like, this is a world that doesn't exist, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's once removed from ours. And I thought that was a really cool detail. But yeah, it's almost, you know, poking fun at some of that stuff, too.
Well, it's absolutely because Monsieur Gustave is so pretentious in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing he does that's original, that's not serving other people or whatever, is his poetry, unless I'm mistaken. And it's not very good. You know,
right.
But he says it as if it's amazing. And so at one point toward the end, the letter boy says a little piece of poetry and he goes, oh, that's quite good. Yeah, so he's starting to become more in his image.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, with the poetry.
And he becomes a writer. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. No, cool. He doesn't become a writer.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Zero.
Zero's not the author, though. The author is Jude Law.
Of course. Yes, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's right.
Yeah.
Yep, you're right. Yep.
Yeah. But there is a book of poetry and that kind of thing. That,
yeah. Yeah, and he gives his girlfriend a book.
Yes.
A book of romantic poems.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So
awesome.
Anyway, yeah. So well, it's cool. Very confusing. It's nested.
Yeah, it is nested.
I don't remember who's
new. Yeah, it's good.
But it's a lot of fun.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm glad you enjoyed it, and that was a fascinating conversation. I appreciate that.
Oh well.
Yeah.
Who knows what springs to mind when we see all this stuff, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So coming up next, is there anything else you wanted to say? I should ask that first.
Okay. That's it.
Yep. So coming up next is, I don't know, just a little something. The Book of Jonah, written by somebody.
You'll find it in a larger library called the Bible.
That's right. The Book of Jonah.
Yeah, we go from a whole movie that's essentially about nothing to or that's a fable with not a lot of meaning to another thing that a lot of people consider is a fable that's got so much meaning. It only covers two pages, but oh my goodness. So the opposite, I guess.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're keeping our theme.
I love it. All right. So, yeah, we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, thank you.
Enjoy that movie, by the way. Enjoy.
Bye-bye. Bye.